It's KJZZ's Here and Now in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Author H.G. Wells is known for an array of popular stories that have stood the test of, well, time, including The Time Machine and The War of the Worlds. Wells has been back in the news this week because of the publication of a long-forgotten short story called The Haunted Ceiling. Also, Star Wars fans have been getting pumped up for the premiere of Rogue One, a new part of the canon of stories about Jedis and the Force and the Empire. That movie opens on December 16th. With me to talk about those happenings and others from the world of sci-fi and pop culture are Bob Beard and Joey Eschrick of ASU Center for Science and the Imagination. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Joey, you're our resident H.G. Wells expert. So how far ahead of his time, though, was H.G. Wells? We're still seeing excitement over his stories even to this day.
Yeah, I think the publication of this story, which is not a very typical Wells story, it's a bit more Edgar Allan Poe-esque in some ways. It's not the kind of Wells storytelling that we think about, the really sweeping stories about aliens and time travel and really drastic advances in technology. But it was a good reminder of how ahead of his time Wells was in some ways, that he is this figure who was both kind of a futurist. Somebody might we might call a strategic foresight consultant today. This is a term of art in the corporate world, and a science fiction author. This sort of visionary storyteller, and he's someone whose authority as a futurist and an expert about where society was going and the forces that were pushing it in that direction came from not necessarily his professional qualifications. You know, it's not as if he had a huge stack of PhDs. It's that he had this very powerful imagination. That was kind of his personal brand in a way, that he was this person who could sort of command all of this knowledge from all over the place and sort of zero down into what's a city going to look like in 100 years, or what is the UK or the US going to look like in 100 years, or what is aerial combat or poverty and wealth going to look like in the future. And this idea of having somebody who spans kind of futurism and the sort of technological world and also the storytelling and science fiction world is still kind of a cutting edge idea today. There's just starting to be more awareness among corporations and governments that you can kind of hire these people and bring them in and sort of help you think about issues ranging from national security to like the future of furniture in your home. Like Lowe's has a futurist now. But Wells was already doing this, a century ago. That's amazing.
I want to have you both comment on this. Bob, let me start with you. I'm curious, even with there was the recent Showtime program, Penny Dreadful.
Uh-huh.
There's the graphic novels, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, where you're putting together these. People are still so fascinated, whether it's the characters that Wells created or Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde or Dracula or Frankenstein. Where does this all play, do you think, in the canon of all this stuff?
So I think a lot of, you know, especially with the ones that you mentioned, Penny Dreadful and League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and all of the H.G. Wells stuff, I mean, that's all steampunk, you know, and steampunk is very much sort of imagining an alternate future shaped by a different technology. And so I think, you know, where we are now, where we're faced with all of these different technological choices, it's fun to speculate sort of how those things could change and the different sort of futures that we could have based on the decisions that we make today.
Yeah, steampunk, that's interesting. The whole gothic, things are so gothic, and yet I think it's incredible the way that these things have almost a crossover, Joey. The fact that it's still, there are people of all different varieties who are interested in the classic lit, but also putting sort of a future sci-fi tone to it.
Yeah, and that's something Wells was really aware of, this idea of keeping things constant and then changing things in storytelling. Mm-hmm. Sort of a horizon of intelligibility for the stories, that if you change too many things at once, people would have no anchor and they wouldn't be able to make sense of the future world you were telling stories about. And that strikes me as appropriate in this moment when we are seeing a lot of stories that are kind of taking familiar tropes and elements and images from the past, but then mixing them with new either special effects technologies or also new kind of unforeseen technological ideas or forms of magic, you know, in some of these stories. Wells had this very strong belief that in order to get to a future world that people could connect to emotionally, you didn't want to change too many things. You actually just wanted to make one change and kind of play out the implications mm-hmm. of that one big change. So each of his stories has what science fiction critics today call a novum at the center. It's a one completely new idea that would kind of signal to us that we were in a different kind of reality, that we had jumped across a point of departure from our mm-hmm. familiar world and mm-hmm. into a new space. And I think some of these new shows and entertainment properties that are mixing old and new and trying to blend them in ways that play on emotional associations we already have, pick up that same lesson.
Last time you were here, we talked a little about dystopian society and whatnot. And I wonder, was there, when there were fewer people with this sort of ability to imagine the future, at least I'm throwing that out, that Wells had, did we see things that were maybe less dystopian as we've lived and as we've seen what technology can do? Are people more inclined to be a little bit more nervous about it? There may not be evidence for it, just as kind of a discussion point.
Sure. Well, I can just give a tiny bit of historical context on Wells, and that's that he was in this circle of people who were writing a lot of utopian fiction at the time. So one of the people in his circle, for example, was Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who wrote a bunch of utopian novels. One is called Her Land, and it's about a utopian society that's composed entirely of women. And she, you know, a lot of these utopian people in Wells' circle were feminists, and they were writing really politically inclined fiction that talked about, well, what if we organize society differently? What if we question some of the assumptions that we're making, not just about gender and race, but also about human nature and about things like our propensity for violence? What if we turned some of our assumptions on their head and then see what kind of society we come up with? Wells was somebody who wrote a bunch of utopian novels as well as a few dystopias, including a couple that had to do with nuclear war, something he was a bit ahead of his time on and really concerned about. So there was a lot of thinking about futures, but maybe not in the technological way that we were thinking about. Wells is kind of a bit more technological than the people that he's in dialogue with. A lot of them are much more thinking about futures in a political and social way without the kind of gadgets at the center of them.
About other technology, I want to talk about this new Star Wars film coming out, Star Wars-related film at least, Rogue One, coming out December 16th. What is the staying power of Star Wars? And if, let's say, The Force Awakens had never happened, would Star Wars still have that popularity among the generations, or did those second group of three movies turn some people off?
Yeah, so I think that what's really interesting with Star Wars is The Force Awakens is really the first internet Star Wars or the first social media Star Wars, I should say, right? And so all of these fan practices have been there, but I think The Force Awakens really sort of brought it to light, and it was like, oh, look, there's a ton of activity around this. But yeah, I think that. All of the Star Wars movies, and now they've been sort of industrialized, and there's so much attention being paid to it and so much money going into Star Wars, is that, you know, fandom is largely a collaborative activity. And I think the cultural producers, you know, are trading on that. They're very savvy to know that there's a whole lot of, you know, knowledge exchange is going on. And so it sort of behooves, you know, the Star Wars universe or the business of Star Wars to expand that universe for greater representation and greater participation. And so fans can really participate however they choose to and in whatever way that they feel comfortable. And I think what's, you know, great about that fan culture is that they're learning how to be good citizens in that imaginary world. And so hopefully that can bleed over to the real world. If you can be a good citizen in the imaginary world, then maybe you have greater agency to make changes in the real one.
Well, how much are fans counting on this to go a certain path? Because one of the things that I'm sure people aren't concerned about necessarily, but when you start doing more and more and saying, okay, we have to feed the beast even more, is there a concern that you're going to create storylines that are hard to bring together, or the quality of each film is not going to be as good?
Sure. I mean, you know, that's the tension with these big blockbuster movies that are really a gateway into the fandom, right? You need something that's familiar and accessible, but it's not a carbon copy. And so you have that success in, you know, The Force Awakens, like arguably they did that very well. And then you have something like, you know, the 2016 Ghostbusters, which, you know, was familiar, and it is, you know, the same sort of storyline, and it was just, you know, completely just slagged. So,
but that had other elements to it, where people's expectations were gonna change. So I don't know if Star Wars kind of fits better into the consistency of a tale or of a whole history.
I think it's because the universe is so big, right? Like, you can be. You're not, when you are imagining yourself in the Star Wars universe, you're not, you know, these core group of characters. You're not Luke Skywalker. You're just a citizen of this universe. And so I think it's a bigger playground to be in. I think it's a bigger sandbox.
Joe, you've got about 30 seconds. Any thoughts on that? No Star Wars?
I don't think I have anything to say about Star Wars. I'm only here to talk about H.G. Wells.
Bob Beard and Joey Eschrick of ASU's Center for Science and the Imagination, Whetting Our Appetite for Star Wars, also revisiting H.G. Wells. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you.